Natural Sciences of Philadelphia is marking its 200th birthday this year with a series of special events, including a new exhibit, performances, tours, talks, and a beautiful new book. It's called A Glorious Enterprise, and it's about the Academy's founders, its philosophy and expeditions, and its extraordinary collection of specimens, including mollusks, bird skins, shells, fossils, and insects. The Academy houses millions of these specimens collected by a diverse group of people, from Thomas Jefferson to John James Audubon to Ernest Hemingway and the real James Bond. The Academy has also been a research institution with scientists doing field work all over the world. It recently merged with Drexel University here in Philadelphia. We asked Robert McCracken-Peck to join us on Radio Times. He's a senior fellow and curator of art and artifacts at the Academy, also co-author of A Glorious Enterprise. And Bob Peck, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Nice to have you here. Also with us is paleontologist Ted Deschler. He's curator and chair of vertebrate zoology at the Academy. He was last on Radio Times to talk about the discovery of the fossil Tiktaalik rosae. And Ted Deschler, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Great to be here.
Nice to have you both here. And Bob, if I can begin with you and just roll the clock back 200 years to the founding of the Academy. What was the inspiration for the Academy of Natural Sciences?
Well, I can really answer that in two ways. One, it was a group of amateur naturalists who got together to share their enthusiasm for nature, their collections, their books, their knowledge. But also, it was a political statement. I think it's no coincidence that it was 1812 that the founding occurred, just as the United States was declaring its military, political, and economic independence a second time from England. So these men wanted to declare an intellectual independence from the old world.
From Europe, I guess.
Up until that period, any new discovery that was made in North America had to be sent to England or Paris, somewhere in Europe, for the scientists there to identify it, verify it, and ultimately publish it. They would sometimes take years to do that, and the poor Americans who had gone to all the work to find these things were often left wondering whatever happened. The European scientists would often name the new species in honor of their own friends and their patrons and so on, and never even mention the Americans again. So this group thought if they could establish an institution that could do all of this domestically, it would be a much better thing for the United States.
You also write that it had a, quote, moralistic philosophy or idea, and quoting here from some early documents, in this large city, the young men generally have few modes of social recreation when their daily business is over except frequenting the theaters at considerable expense, taverns, gaming houses, dancing rooms, or places of more degrading atmosphere where they can gain no improvement but are sure to acquire habits injurious to the spirit of a good citizen. So the idea was also to get these guys off the streets and doing something productive?
I guess a bit of that. Yes, it was a wonderful way for people to engage with the natural world and do it in a respectable manner. They could come back and share information and then eventually publish on their findings.
And Ted, has it kept you off the streets of Phila in these taverns?
It has. I've been there for almost 25 years now, working at the Academy, and it's been a fantastic place to work for that time and kept me out of trouble.
And kept you out of trouble as well. Do you remember your first visit to the Academy?
I think Bob was probably there when I visited. Yes, he would have brought me. We're friends from when I was a teenager anyway. And I remember the dioramas very well, first time I walked through. But once you really get behind the scenes and learn about the research and the library and the depth of history and the current activity that goes on there, that's when the Academy really impresses.
And what was your first visit to the Academy about?
Well, I'm a native Philadelphian, so I grew up, my parents would bring me to the museum and school trips and so on, and I think I was in about third or fourth grade, and we were all there in the diorama halls. I remember this vividly to this day. I was looking at the moose diorama, this great iconic image at the end of the hall, and apparently I was so absorbed by that that I didn't notice that the class had moved on to Dinosaur Hall or somewhere else. And the teachers, of course, got very upset and rushed all around the museum looking for me because I was lost. But as far as I was concerned, I was never lost. I knew exactly where I was, where I wanted to be. And those dioramas, to this day, still inspire me. They are sort of a window into the outside world.
They're also an example of a certain kind of a display in a museum, the diorama.
Yes, it's interestingly typically American invention, the diorama. It was Charles Wilson Peale here in Philadelphia who first came up with the concept back in the 18th century in his own museum, the second floor of Independence Hall. Then it sort of went out of fashion for a while, and then in the 1920s, dioramas began to be reinvented, and the American Museum in New York was a pioneer in that, the Field Museum in Chicago, but the Academy had some of the very best in the country, and it was a fascinating process, which we describe in the book in some detail, that starts in the field with the expeditions, brings the material back, and then a whole team of artists very skillfully put these things together to create a realistic habitat. And we've just opened a new exhibit all about the secrets of the diorama and how they're put together.
Well, you're a paleontologist, and I'm assuming, Ted, that just seeing some of those dinosaur structures and bones was in part an inspiration for what you end up doing.
Absolutely. You know, growing up and having I actually grew up outside New York, so I would go to the American Museum of Natural History and see those skeletons. And just in general, natural history was something that always intrigued me, a family that would get us out into nature whenever possible and get us interested in flowers and insects and birds, and I just connected with geology and fossils particularly. And I think that's one of the things that the Academy can do to people today. It's hard to get out into nature, and especially in the urban environment here, and so more than ever, it's very relevant what the Academy can present and teach and just give people that experience of sitting in front of a diorama or at a program and experiencing something real.
I remember taking my son when he was pretty little to see, you know, dinosaur bones and some of these reconstructed dinosaurs, and he just stood in the hallway and just said, "Oh my God!"
Fantastic.
You know, and that sort of said it all.
We associate skeletons of dinosaurs with natural history museums now all over the world, but actually, the first one ever done was here in Philadelphia at the Academy in 1868. Up until that time, people exhibited dinosaurs usually, or any kind of prehistoric creature, as a pile of bones, and you really had to be a specialist to understand how they fit together. But one of the scientists at the Academy, Joseph Leidy, working with a British artist named Benjamin Waterhouse Hawkins, realized that if they could articulate the bones in a realistic way, it would make the creature much more easily understood. And it had such a huge impact that when they opened the display in 1868, the cusp of 68-69, people surged to see it. And within the next year, 100,000 people visited the Academy, even though the museum was only open for 2 afternoons a week.
Wow. Wow. Ted, you talked about the behind the scenes at the Academy, and I'm thinking about the millions of specimens that are stored there. Is there any way to describe what is behind the scenes there?
The easiest way to think about it is as a library of life. Just like a library full of books, everything is carefully organized, you can find what you need to in the subject matter that you're interested in. The Academy is a library of life on Earth, going back through time, going to all environments on Earth, you know, geographically, and then taxonomically, from the smallest diatom to dinosaurs and everything in between. And we have to realize that every single one of those specimens that is preserved, and there's upwards of 18 million organisms at the Academy, every single one is a data point.
Yeah,
an organism at a time and place. And more than ever, we're finding that each one of those specimens offers not only the information about what that animal looks like, what the variation is within that same species, those sorts of questions, but now there's biochemical data, DNA and things.
That's there even in something preserved 100 or 200 years.
Absolutely. And even geochemical data. And the amazing thing there is that we actually can use specimens now to track environmental change by the isotopes that are preserved within the feathers or the hair or the bones of these animals. So each one of them is a time capsule of a time and place, allows us to track the changes that have happened on Earth, whether it's human-induced or natural.
Well, and it's interesting, Bob, that the people, the collectors seem to know how to preserve these specimens. Were there Was this sort of cutting-edge technology that they used, or just common sense?
Well, a little bit of both, and they struggled with that because it's the natural nature of things to deteriorate. There are also insect pests that can get in and so on. And so scientists through time developed ways to protect them and essentially stop the erosion that time will create. Some of the methods they used proved to be quite unhealthy. In fact, we had a number of curators who eventually died from arsenic poisoning, because arsenic was a very important early preservative rubbed into the skins of birds and mammals, and they were inhaling clouds of arsenic dust day after day. They were so devoted to their work that they even recognizing that it was life-threatening, continued to do it. Others developed a system, particularly with insects. Titian Ramsey Peel discovered that by baking his insects in an oven at a very low temperature, he could kill all of the other insects that were trying to eat them. Nowadays, interestingly, we do almost the opposite. We put things into a deep freeze, and it kills the insect pests and the eggs that they have laid.
In the book, there also, and I wasn't sure when I first looked at it what I was looking at, but these were snake skins curled up, and there was twine wrapped around them. Is that how they are preserved?
They are. That is an interesting collection. Actually, it was done in the 1940s, and those are all actually shed snake skins. So somebody had to take the time to find these things in either a wild habitat or with a captive snake, and then carefully preserve them through time.
And you see the kind of different kind of honeycomb design in the skin.
They're quite beautiful. And in fact, one of the things in this book, we wanted to stress the beauty of nature, because that's often the way people are first drawn to it. We were very fortunate to work with an amazing photographer named Rosamund Purcell, who came to the Academy on three different trips, spending a week each time photographing these specimens under natural light conditions. And she manages to take these and really give them a whole new interpretation.
Do you have a favorite time at the Academy, Ted?
You know what? I would just pick up on what Bob mentioned about Rosamund Purcell. As one who had the pleasure of working with her a little bit, it's incredible how, you know, these specimens, which have their life as scientific objects, also have this incredible artistic perspective as well. Individually or as a group, you know, these things are absolutely beautiful. And Rosamund's eye to pick up on these things, a fossil skull that I've looked at dozens of times and thought about, oh, what are those teeth? And is it being preserved properly? And this, that, the other thing. She pulls out and does something very artistic with. And I think it goes to show something that we actually are trying to accentuate, both in the new exhibit that's at the Academy. We have a gallery, the Art of Science gallery at the Academy. We're trying to accentuate that sort of humanist side of science.
Well, let's pick up on that after this very short break. We are talking about the Academy of Natural Sciences of Philadelphia, marking its 200th birthday this year. And there's a brand new book. I can barely lift it, but I did enjoy it. It's called A Glorious Enterprise, written or co-written by one of our guests, Bob Peck. Also with us is paleontologist Ted Deschler. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Lincoln, introducing the new 2013 Lincoln MKS with continuously controlled damping, or CCD. More at Lincoln.com. Lincoln, now it gets interesting.
Delaware Theater Company supports WHYY and presents Regina Taylor's gospel musical, Crowns, April 11th through 29th. Based on the book by Michael Cunningham and Craig Marbury, Crowns is the story of a young woman who moves down south to live with her grandmother and is given a lesson on hattitude. This toe-tapping musical shows there are hats for every occasion and a cultural and historical significance to them as well. For tickets, 302-594-1100 or DelawareTheater.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with R.A. Dickey, currently the only knuckleball pitcher in the major league.
I've heard it said that a knuckleball is like trying to hit a butterfly in a typhoon. You know, it shakes side to side. It may go straight left.
Dickey has a new memoir called Wherever I Wind Up. Join us this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Peggy and Steve Morgan of Marlton support WHYY and encourage listeners to visit the Philadelphia Zoo's newest interactive exhibit, Trail of the Lorax, based on the Dr. Seuss book, now through October 31st. Tickets at philadelphiazoo.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The Academy of Natural Sciences of Philadelphia is celebrating its 200th anniversary this year. It was started by citizen scientists, and it's now the oldest natural history museum in the Western Hemisphere, home to millions and millions of specimens. We're talking about a book which is written by our guest, Bob Peck, and Patricia Tyson Stroud, called A Glorious Enterprise, about the 200 years of the Academy. Also with us is paleontologist Ted Deschler, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Normally, I scribble all over the books that I have given, and this one I have little post-its here, so I'm not ruining it in any way. But, Bob, if I can go back to you, you have a chapter on skulls and the fascinating story of some of these skulls. I'm looking at one, and written on this skull says, a native of South Australia hanged at Port Phillip for murder.
This is a remarkable collection that was made by a man named Samuel Morton in the 1830s and 40s. And he was teaching comparative anatomy. Originally, this collection began because he needed to have teaching props. And he realized that if he could get a couple of skulls, he could show different kinds of people, where they had come from, talk about evolution or migration, perhaps. You know, were Native Americans evolved from Mongolians or from Asians who came across the Bering Strait? Anyway, his collection grew and grew until finally he had over 1,000 human skulls. These are now in the anthropology department at the University of Pennsylvania.
Here's one. It says, skull of Pierce, a convict and cannibal who was executed in New South Wales in
20s, yes. He tried to document these skulls as well as he could, and a lot of them have fascinating stories behind them. There was also a collector of about the same period who collected human hair, and he's discussed in the book and illustrated. He thought that by looking at hair under a microscope, he might be able to determine how people were related to one another around the world. It turns out, the physical principles probably, it wasn't a valid way of defining the differences, but we now have that hair and the DNA that Ted was referring to earlier. So there are many questions that could still be answered by collections that were made hundreds of years ago.
But Ted, it's so interesting to read about Joseph Leidy and to see his contributions to the Academy, and then to fast forward to the kind of work that you're doing on Tiktaalik Rosae.
Oh, well, thank you. I'd love to be compared to Joseph Leidy any day.
But it's part of this tradition of expedition, of exploration, of trying to figure out the natural world.
Absolutely. And although we talk about our 200-year history, we look forward now to the next 200 years, too. I mean, the Academy is a very vibrant place, and so we can stand on Leidy's shoulders, if you will, and continue the work, both in natural sciences and environmental sciences. And the work I've been doing and the expeditionary work is one of the really exciting aspects of what goes on at the Academy. I get to go to the High Canadian Arctic to look at Devonian Age rocks, which are basically unexplored. So we're some of the first people to walk that ground and look at fossils from that place, from that period of time. But I find similar and some of them equally scientifically important fossils on road cuts in Pennsylvania. Right. So a lot of our work, our environmental work particularly, is Delaware Valley oriented and is cutting edge. So we got it all. We got the past, the present, and we're looking for the future as well.
Well, I remember you coming in to talk about Tiktaalik. This was a couple of years ago, and the importance of that particular find and what you're learning, I guess, about evolution.
Absolutely. It's a really interesting animal because it's a very good intermediary form between what we call fishes. In other words, finned animals living in an aquatic world, and then the earliest tetrapods, which are limbed animals. Now, to go from a fin to a limb sounds like a dramatic change, Well, given 20 million years of evolutionary change, which this particular group was going through, we're finding these steps along the way. And so Tiktaalik Rosae has been an important find for us and just one of many.
Well, and going to you, Bob, you've been doing work in Mongolia for about 20 years now.
Yes, I've been part of a team that's been working consistently in Mongolia, first on aquatic studies and more recently on climate change issues. And it was a fascinating country to visit beginning back in the early 90s because it had been a communist country and was pretty much cut off to the West. And the academy was the first institution invited in by the government to help them with water studies.
And is that what you're studying, water?
We started that way, and more recently we've been looking at climate change, and particularly last summer I was interviewing with a colleague, Clyde Goulden, families, nomadic herding families, to see how their lives have been affected by both warming and cooling conditions.
And have you seen some changes? And
definitely. There are
over the 20-year
dramatic
period?
Changes. And it's climate change is a very complex issue, of course. The country as a whole seems to be warming, but parts of it are cooling because the heat comes up off the Gobi and sucks cold air down from the Arctic and across Siberia. So the northern part of the country is actually colder, which is providing great challenges for the herding families because their animals can be caught in late spring storms or early fall snowfalls.
You mentioned water, and Ruth Patrick, of course, an important person at the Academy, has been doing or has done groundbreaking research on water.
Absolutely. And my co-author in this book, Patricia Stroud, wrote the chapter that deals with Ruth Patrick's work. Beginning in the 1930s, she recognized that water was going to be a serious issue for us going forward, and she found new ways of determining the health in a stream or lake by the organisms that live within it, particularly little single-celled organisms called diatoms.
Well, we are talking about the Academy of Natural Sciences of Philadelphia celebrating its 200th birthday anniversary. I'm not sure which word to use. Talking with Bob Peck, co-author with Patricia Tyson Stroud of a new book called A Glorious Enterprise about the history of the Academy, the making of American science. Also with us is Ted Deschler. He's a paleontologist, curator, chair of vertebrate zoology at the Academy. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Louise from Norristown to join us. Louise, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
I just wanted to tell the speakers, it's very interesting, that I was substitute teaching in a fifth grade last week, and in the anthology was a wonderful story about Woodhouse Hawkins and how his sculpture's ability helped to bring these dinosaurs to life and how he had to impress the paleontologists. And it was just one of those things that now a whole new generation is learning about the whole process.
Well, that's great. Louise, yeah, go ahead, Ted.
You know, one of the things that he was, Waterhouse Hawkins was sort of pre-adapted, if you would, for helping to reconstruct these dinosaur skeletons because he had been a lithographer. And if he had to illustrate something, he had to first draw an opposite mirror image of it for the lithographic engraving. So when it came to these dinosaurs and we had a left femur, he could create the right femur. And so in these incomplete, very earliest dinosaur skeletons like Hadrosaurus fulci, he sort of had that ability in his brain to create the opposite side and therefore build a complete skeleton.
You want to add to that, Bob?
Well, Hawkins was a fascinating guy. These dinosaurs that you're referring to, the first sculpture ones he did for the Crystal Palace exhibition in England in 1853, and then came to America. And he found that the only place people really knew about dinosaurs was at the Academy of Natural Sciences. So he spent a lot of time in Philadelphia.
You go, Philadelphia. And Louise, thank you for calling into Radio Times. Let me get, it looks like Liddy from Powelton to join us. And Liddy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to say I was just in London. I just returned, and Saturday we happened to visit the British Museum of Natural History, or the official name for it. And it was teeming with people, and we did go down the corridor of the bird specimens, and I was just shocked to see the birds were sitting on just plain blue backgrounds. I've gone to the Academy of Natural Sciences all my life. And I'm a native Philadelphian. And it was like, What's wrong with this? A picture's worth a thousand words, you know, when you think of the beautiful landscapes behind all our specimen animals. It was just so bland.
Well, Lydia, it sounds like you got a cold going over there to England, and thanks for calling into Radio Times. Bob,
but
go ahead.
It's very true. American museums realized from the 1930s on how powerful a diorama could be, the impression of seeing something in its natural habitat. And many of the European museums never quite caught up to that or did it. At one time in this country, there were half a dozen or so specialists who did nothing but diorama backgrounds. Sadly, that whole art form has all but disappeared. So we're very fortunate that at the Academy, we still have a number of these wonderful dioramas that were made in the 1930s.
But you're saying we're not making dioramas today? That's sort of a relic of the past?
Well, it's extremely expensive. The American Museum did make a couple within the last few years, and the Carnegie Museum has done them. But there are only a handful of specialists now who can do the very difficult job of making a background appear three-dimensional. They're usually round surfaces that they paint on, but it's a complicated process to get that illusion of depth.
Let me get some more callers in at 1-888-477-9499. And we have, looks like, Michael from Bristol joining us on Radio Times. And Michael, go ahead. You're on the air. Michael?
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Has the Academy of Natural Sciences seen the special on PBS television, The First Americans, that the stone tools of North, Central, and South America are of European origin?
Michael, let me toss that to Ted Deschler.
Michael, although the Academy of Natural Sciences does not do archaeology, and then there's always that slight confusion between paleontology and archaeology. They actually, way back when, Bob would know exactly, the researchers had dealt with archaeological issues, archaeological being human history and the type of stone tools that you're asking about. So it is not an area that we currently do any kind of research in. I'll tell you that the group of people who work at the Academy certainly are interested in all the same things that you are and try to keep up with the pace of discoveries outside of their specializations. So I haven't personally seen what you're referring to.
You want to add to that, Bob?
Well, at one time, the Academy did have a very active department dealing with human history. And there was a great symposium in 1937, about the origin of man. We had extensive collections. Those in the beginning in the 1940s were deaccessioned or exchanged with other institutions like the University Museum here in Philadelphia, the Museum of the American Indian in New York, and Smithsonian.
Well, you also write, Bob, about the fact that, at least in the beginning, the idea was to be a political, a religious, a meaning, you know, without. But I guess Darwin, evolution, politics... Mm-hmm. It's hard to separate
hard
those.
Hard to separate. They were very clear in the outset, and some of the founding documents specifically prohibit the discussion of religion or politics. And yet, through time, those things inevitably filter into the discussion. You mentioned Darwin, and that's an important name to include in this conversation because he was elected to membership at the Academy of Natural Sciences in 1860. We were the first American institution to recognize Darwin. And it was Joseph Leidy, who we mentioned earlier, who admired his work, recognized its validity, and encouraged the Academy to elect him to membership. There were still some among the group, just as everywhere around the world at the time, who weren't completely on board with the ideas. But as time went on, they became more and more evident, and Darwinism and evolution was embraced by the institution.
Anything you want to add to that, Ted?
Not particularly. There was except to mention that back to Leidy, that there is a correspondence from Darwin to Leidy saying how much he valued Leidy's work, and that gets to Leidy's skill at documenting nature, you know, at What do we see when we start to study these things, particularly the fossils? How do we classify them? And those are the types of data that Darwin needed to put together the whole concept of change through time, descent with modification, all those sorts of things. And so the foundation work that was done here in North America by people like Joseph Leidy was part of Darwin's thinking. And you could say the same thing today, that some of the work we do will inform the next great idea that's out there.
But even picking up on that, Bob, I'm thinking, I mean, the future is often nano. I mean, it's, you know, it's cells. It's things we can't see that can't necessarily be displayed in a display case.
No, the interpretation of it is always difficult, but it does, that gets back to the importance of amassing these collections. The Academy collected things, some of which they weren't sure exactly what the uses would be, and years later they were able to ask questions that the original collectors would never have thought to ask. And so these serve as sort of a baseline for any kind of investigation going forward. And I'm sure there are things now that we can't imagine that our the people who follow us will be able to use these collections, and because of how well they're documented, they'll always be a valid source of information.
Well, and I'm assuming we're still looking for birds that we don't know about yet, or mollusks, or
yes, there are new discoveries made all the time, and the Academy continues to be very much a part of that process. It's remarkable how much of the world we still know so little about.
Would you agree with that, Ted, as someone who is exploring the world, the past?
Absolutely. And we have people who explore our collections as well. And to get to your first point, you know, people are looking now at the molecular level, at the preserved compounds that are in some of the materials, again, bones, feathers, whatever the case might be, and using that information to ask scientific questions. Mm-hmm. We can't begin to imagine what questions will come up in the future, but there's no doubt that things that are in these mm-hmm. collections right now will be informative, or things that we may add to the collections. Interestingly, when Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf, we very quickly had malacologists work with specimens in our collection to understand a baseline level of hydrocarbons that were in the environments before that activity. And those were from oyster shells that were collected in the Gulf before all of the activities, and especially before the big spill. Similarly, again and again, we find that collections from a particular time and place serve as information sources for that kind of baseline information about environmental change.
And we're almost up on a break here, Bob, but I'm thinking about just preserving and taking care of all these specimens. Do they take care of themselves, or does someone have to come in and dust them?
They definitely do not. No, it's a huge job, and actually there's much more involved than anyone would appreciate. The specimens have to be handled extremely carefully. They have to be constantly refreshed because of the invasion of parasites insects that could come in and do damage. And so every collection has a collection manager, and it's a full-time job just to take care of these 18 million specimens.
Well, we are talking about the Academy of Natural Sciences of Philadelphia, marking its 200th birthday this year, holding a series of special events, a new exhibit, performances, tours, talks, and a new book, which I can hardly lift. It's gorgeous, called A Glorious Enterprise, and written by our guests Bob Peck and Patricia Tyson Stroud. Also with us is Ted Deschler, and he's chair of vertebrate zoology at the Academy. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by the new University Medical Center of Princeton at Plainsboro. Opening May 22nd, the new hospital is being built with all single-patient rooms and has been designed with innovations that may help improve healing and lower infections. Features include a new rapid-response emergency room and CHOP docs to care for children. The new University Medical Center of Princeton at Plainsboro, redefining care. Opening May 22nd. More at princetonhcs.org.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Tensions between the U.S. and Iran are at a high point, but mountaineers from both countries are scaling heights together, there and here. Also, a new novel tells the story of a character who'd be happy hanging out with Holden Caulfield and Nick Carraway. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Christopher Dock Mennonite High School supports WHYY, located in Lansdale, Pennsylvania. Christopher Dock seeks to develop the God-given gifts of students, preparing them to be responsible members of a global society. Christopher Dock offers a wide range of honors and AP courses and builds community through participation in the arts and athletics. An open house with campus tours is Thursday, April 12th from 3 to 5 p.m. More information is available at DockHS.org or Christopher Dock on Facebook.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with Ted Deschler and Bob Peck. And we are talking about the Academy of Natural Sciences of Philadelphia and the millions of specimens that have been collected and are on display there or being held there. And the Academy marking its 200th birthday this year. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Bob, I was leafing through this book, and lo and behold, there's Ernest Hemingway holding a big fish.
Yes, not who you would expect to find in a book about the Academy. But Hemingway actually was quite interested in fish, not only as a hobby, but he was scientifically interested. And the Academy contacted him in the early 30s to say we were doing some work on the fishes of the Atlantic, and might he be willing to help us? And he not only helped, he invited the curator of ichthyology and the president of the Academy to come down to Cuba and spend 6 weeks with him on his boat fishing every day. They went out and collected marlin and swordfish and sailfish and so on. And it actually helped quite a lot as Henry Fowler determined the way in which these fish live and how they change over time. Hemingway continued to correspond with the Academy and actually sent specimens up packed in big vats of alcohol, which he said was sort of a waste.
He could have used it himself.
He could have used it in other ways.
Is there any way to know if the Academy influenced the old man in the sea?
We think absolutely it did. He gives lots of specific information in that book that he no doubt got from his time with Henry Fowler and Charles Cadwallader.
Let me ask about one more, and then, Ted, I have a question for you, then we'll get back to our callers. How about James Bond, and I guess we should call him the real James Bond.
The real James Bond.
Right.
The real James Bond was actually an ornithologist who worked at the Academy for many, many years. He was a specialist in the birds of the West Indies, that is the Caribbean, and he had written a very popular field guide to the birds in that region. Ian Fleming, the writer, the author who invented the new James Bond, 007, was an avid bird watcher, and he had James Bond's book on his bedside table and apparently woke up one night thrashing about and trying to decide a good name for his lead character, and he spotted this on the spine of the jacket. The two men did eventually meet, and they had a wonderful time together, but it was sort of a running joke for a long time because everywhere James Bond went from that time on, he was given special treatment.
Yes. Well, it might have been good for the Academy to get all that attention. Ted, there's an exhibition now. I know you've been involved in putting that on in celebration of the Academy's birthday.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, everyone in the Academy has been involved with it in one way or another. I had the honor of helping to organize with our in-house exhibit folks. We had some people from outside, very talented group of people putting together the celebration of our 200th, basically. And it tells some of these stories that Bob tells in the book, some of them. It brings us up to the present. It allows young people to sort of experience the activity of doing science, whether it's marshes and wetlands here in Pennsylvania, or whether it's digging for fossils in Patagonia. It's all really exciting times to get people involved, families, young people. And we also brought out a huge collection of things from behind the scenes. Oh, wow. It's a great opportunity. And so we really had a great time putting it together. It's an exciting exhibit. It's very immersive. It's not something that you would get to see very often except on our 200th. So we encourage people to come in and check it out. And along with it goes a bunch of programming through the year, behind-the-scenes tours monthly to different areas. It's been great.
Is it hard to decide what to put? I mean, you have so much to choose from. Hard to decide. So what gets displayed? What gets the public attention?
Absolutely. In fact, the things that were chosen to put out, particularly on this wall of specimens, as we call it, we're not out there because they're the most beautiful or the most interesting. In fact, you could look at any one of the 18 million types of things and the stories that go with them or the ideas that they represent about how we acquire specimens or curate them or how we make them available for research. you could look at any single specimen in the entire museum and come up with the story about it. So it was difficult to choose.
Now, the Academy has merged with Drexel University in Philadelphia. What do you think, Bob, that means for the Academy? Survival?
Well, it provides all kinds of opportunities for us going forward. We will be working closely with the faculty at Drexel, creating a biological department, all new courses to be offered. There's talk of museum studies courses. There's history of science courses. The design departments at Drexel. Drexel is such a multifaceted university that we link and overlap with them in many, many ways. And I think having the students coming through and being involved with all of our work is going to be hugely energizing for the institution. We've always been involved with education, really from 1817 on. But this does it at a whole different level, a whole scale that we've not experienced before.
Yeah, go ahead, Ted.
Bob mentioned this new department, and it's been really exciting. We've worked with our colleagues at Drexel, particularly in their sort of environmental science group, and we've with them developed a curriculum for a new department that's called Biodiversity, Earth, and Environmental Science. And we and they hope that together this is a very powerful new place for students to get the experience of working on the questions in the world. And these are all very relevant questions about biodiversity, about environmental science. And the resources that we can offer at the Academy are unique. The affiliation with Drexel has really offered the university access to resources that are confined to places like Harvard and Yale. So for Drexel and the Academy, it was win-win.
Let me get some more callers in on the conversation. We have, looks like Bob from Livermore, California. Is that right? Go ahead, Bob. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, great. Yeah, just an odd question, but I used to go there with my kids a lot, and one thing that we always passed by on the third or fourth floor somewhere up there, there was a cannon. Sitting there sort of all by itself. And I always wondered what that was there for.
Yeah. Well, you called the right place, Bob. go ahead.
It's a great,
another Bob.
A great question. That was actually a cannon that originally was on HMS Endeavour, Captain Cook's ship that went around the world. And it ran aground on the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. And in order to get the ship off, Captain Cook decided that he had to lighten the load, and so everything that could possibly be thrown overboard was. The cannon were the most heavy parts of the cargo, so off went six cannon into the reef, and they remained. It's a bit like the Titanic, which we're thinking about this week. For several hundred years, those cannon were lost, and then it was an Academy expedition in the 1960s to the Great Barrier Reef, where we were looking at fish and coral and so on, that found the cannon again. We brought them all up, gave them to the government of Australia, and as a thank you, they presented one of the cannon back to the Academy of Natural Sciences.
Wow. Let me go back to you, Ted. And Bob, I'd like to hear from you as well. And we were talking about dioramas, and we're all sort of old enough to be wowed by dioramas. I don't know if that's as exciting to kids today, because so much of their world is, you know, they can access this on their computer, or it's interactive in a way that a diorama might not be, you know, physically interactive. Is it a challenge, Ted, to sort of keep up with a public that I think demands, I'm not saying it's entertainment, but demands a certain kind of experience in a museum?
Yep. Absolutely, and it's very much an ongoing discussion at the Academy, not only what to do to get the most out of the dioramas, but other kinds of programming, other kinds of exhibits that will have the most impact. One thing that the Academy has, above anything you can get on your computer or see on television, is authenticity.
The real thing, right?
The real stuff, the real people, the real stories. I think that's the niche that we can offer, and I think that's probably the best learning opportunity that we can give people. And personally, I think it's better than what you can get online or something. We want to inspire young people to think about nature, to get out into nature, to learn on the outside when they're not at the Academy. Right. And I think part of that comes from the authentic nature of the experience when you're in our building looking at our exhibits.
You agree with that, Bob? I'm sure you do, but agree with that.
The dioramas are interesting as an example because it's the questions you ask about them that make them relevant. That they may not have changed since the 1930s, but the environmental issues that surround them have. These animals have become extinct in some cases, or they've become rare or endangered in others. The habitats have changed dramatically. And so when a class gathers in front of one of these dioramas, it's what the teacher brings to the discussion that makes it come alive.
But what I hear, even from Lydie and the kind of work, Ted, that you're doing, which is looking back in time, and it sounds like looking forward as well, which is about climate change. It's about how the environment is changing and how, I guess, humans and animals are adapting to a changing environment.
That's right. And this is something the Academy has been interested in and focused on for almost all of its 200 years. You mentioned Dr. Ruth Patrick earlier and her work on water. She saw things well ahead of the general public's awareness of pollution, and it was thanks to her that, say, the Clean Water Act eventually was shaped and has protected us all from environmental degradation. So we're looking in lots of different directions on lots of different issues. The Marcellus Shale controversy now is one in which Academy scientists are very much involved.
Looking at water?
Studying the water, particularly the groundwater, and how it's affected by the fracking process. Mm-hmm.
And Ted, you're continuing your work with Tiktaalik, but it sounds like other specimens as well.
Oh, absolutely. The Tiktaalik piece continues. More and more refined studies, new specimens, all those sorts of things. We're, of course, interested in the world where animals like Tiktaalik lived, this time period called the Devonian. It's about 360 to 380 million years ago. And it's that idea of exploration, really, that makes it so exciting, whether it's in our own backyard up in Pennsylvania or up in north central Pennsylvania or all the way up in the Canadian Arctic. And again, people are out there exploring from the Academy every day of the year. There's somebody doing something somewhere.
I had asked you earlier a favorite time at the Academy. Do you have one?
A favorite time in history?
No, just sort of... Sometimes I've asked athletes in ballparks, you know, is there a favorite time there where you feel like you have the place to yourself, or I don't know, early in the morning, late at night?
Or
maybe you like the hubbub.
I think I like being immersed in the cabinets and the specimens, and there are times where you are pulling a drawer to look for something and you make a serendipitous discovery of something else, and there's Lydie's handwriting or Edward Drinker Cope's handwriting. Or something that just makes you realize that you are right here in such an important place in the history of natural science.
It's interesting you mentioned handwriting because there's a lot of that in this book where we see people's specimens and their handwriting. I'm always interested in the good penmanship and clearly
beautiful penmanship.
There was beautiful penmanship.
As an historian, as a researcher on this book, it made our lives so much easier. The minutes from the early 19th century were spectacular. We do worry going forward that the documentation of history, not just at the Academy but everywhere, will be more difficult. It might be legible in emails, but how many of the emails are actually being saved?
Oh, interesting.
But that's another whole topic.
It is. And do we still have citizen scientists?
We very much do have citizen scientists, and that's something the Academy encourages. Our town square programs, where everyone in Philadelphia is invited to come and discuss environmental issues and become better informed about them, is really giving the whole conversation about the natural sciences a new life. It's very much a part of what the Academy is doing and will continue to do going forward.
Let me see if I can squeeze Michelle from Trenton on Radio Times. And Michelle, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi there. Hi. I have a suggestion, an idea about how to bring those dioramas into the 21st century. And that would be by using LED screens. And you can project the environment right onto that screen, and you can even start it with the sunrise and going through the day to the sunset. Just like, you know, the Illustrated Man, Ray Bradbury's the one story in there with the kids' room that had the savanna with the lions in it, and it would change scenery. The whole wall would be like that.
I think that's...
I'm looking at Ted here.
That is an exciting idea, and it's... We have these brainstorming sessions occasionally and talk about that kind of thing. It's content, but it's also a delivery system. But you know something, our connections with Drexel now, I think, are going to be a key thing to to bring some of that, make it possible. In fact, we have an iPhone app being developed over at Drexel right now to help in this new exhibit. So I think that's a great idea. I think technology can present some new things, but we do have to keep the experience authentic.
Fair enough. Bob, do you have, this is an unfair question, a favorite founder?
Well, I think probably Thomas Say is everyone's favorite founder. He led a very romantic life, went off and explored in the Rockies, 1819. He was the father of American entomology, that's the study of insects, and the father of American conchology, the study of shells. He eventually went and worked in an idyllic community in New Harmony, Indiana. But he contributed so much to science. He was also just a very likable person, and there's a wonderful biography about him by my co-author, Patricia Tyson Stroud.
And he was called a gentleman of science?
A gentleman of science. He was very much a gentleman, and he was one of those people that everyone liked. We also dealt in this book with lots of people who were quite had quite strong personalities, should we say, and were not always beloved. But Thomas Say, Joseph Leidy, and one or two others stand out as those that you'd really like to have known.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you both for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And Bob Peck, co-author with Patricia Tyson Stroud of this new book called A Glorious Enterprise, and he is a senior fellow, curator of art and artifacts at the Academy of Natural Sciences of Philadelphia, and Ted Deschler, a paleontologist, curator, and chair of vertebrate zoology, also at the Academy. And once again, the Academy celebrating its 200th anniversary this year. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show was produced by Susan Greenbaum, Petty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscow. Thank you so much for joining us.